Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We've been discussing with a number of our guests in recent days developments on the home front aspect of that war, and we have often taken counsel from people associated with the extraordinarily valuable Center for Immigration Studies. And I'm very pleased to say we have with us one of its senior executives, the Director of Policy Studies at the Center for Immigration Studies. Her name is Jessica Vaughn. She has served as a foreign service officer in the Department of State in places like Belgium and in the Caribbean. She is a woman we have very much appreciated her counsel on so many issues in the past, and particularly anxious to catch up with her about the ongoing saga of DACA and more. Jessica, welcome back. It's good to have you. Happy New Year to you.
Thanks, Frank. Glad to be with you. Happy New Year.
Thank you. I saw your boss, Mark Krikorian, on Fox last night talking a bit about the DACA deal and was impressed once again by the importance he attaches to the so-called wall, which, of course, isn't entirely accurate as it's part fence, part natural obstructions, but nonetheless, the importance of securing the border. But he said once again that there's something else that needs to be done, and that is this E-Verify system. I'd like you to talk a little bit about that, why it's so important, and why it doesn't seem to be in the mix in the conversations that are now taking place between President Trump and congressional leaders on what to do about DACA.
Yes, after this very interesting meeting held at the White House the other day, four principles emerged that there is apparently some agreement on that have to be part of a DACA deal, and that's an amnesty for the people who now have DACA, offset by cuts in chain migration and the visa lottery and the border wall, which some see as a metaphor for border security, but, you know, I think a physical wall has a role as well. The big thing missing in this emerging deal is anything that would help prevent illegal immigration in the future. We know from past experience that every amnesty leads to more illegal immigration and more of a sense of entitlement for those still in the country who aren't covered by the amnesty. People come here because they think that they can get a job. And so unless we address the job magnet, no matter how big that wall is, there will still be people trying to go around it. Or they will try to get a tourist visa and come and overstay. Something like at least 40% of the illegal immigrants here today came on a visa. So unless we do something to help employers avoid hiring illegal aliens and prevent illegal aliens from getting employment here, we're not going to solve this problem. E-Verify is the best tool we have. It works. More than half of the new hires today are screened through E-Verify. Employers like it. It's a system that's been in place since 1986, and it needs to be mandated, needs to become the standard operating practice for businesses. But that's missing from this deal that people are talking about right now. But, you know, no matter what we do, it's going to fail unless we address the job magnet. And that's why it's so important. It is in the House bill that's been introduced by Bob Goodlatte and some colleagues. You know, really, the House bill that was recently filed is the bill that comes closest to fulfilling the president's agenda on immigration reform.
I wanted to talk to you about that next, because that does seem to be something of a breakthrough. And I gather that after some backing and filling initially, the House leadership has promised to give the Goodlatte bill a vote, which is extraordinarily important and hopefully will prove successful. It doesn't get you all the way through the process, heavens knows, but it is an important effort to set forth the kind of policy approach that the president has called for. And I just would like to ask you, so why is it that E-Verify isn't in the mix in these negotiations on DACA, as you understand them?
That's a good question. It is in the Senate bill as a reauthorization. And I think this is because it was believed that Democrats perhaps would not go for E-Verify. And I think that tells us something about its prospects for success. They don't want to vote for something that's going to really make progress in reducing illegal immigration.
Talk a little bit about that, because I think this is the dirty little secret about this whole enterprise, that it seems as though they believe, the Democrats, that is, that they can actually benefit from this continued violation of our laws. Hence, as well, their support for sanctuary cities and a lack of interior enforcement, to say nothing of E-Verify's obstruction. Is that a fair characterization of what's going on here, Jessica?
Well, we got some interesting insight into that this week when a memo was leaked from the Center for American Progress, which is one of the think it was basically some big think tank for the Obama administration, pleading with Democratic members of Congress to pass a big amnesty for the Dreamers, even bigger than the DACA beneficiaries, because the Democratic Party needs those voters. So not that it's in the best interest of the country or that it's going to be an economic benefit or even that it's the right thing to do, but that they need these votes.
You know, Jessica, this reminds me, we recently had revelations from Tony Blair's camp in Britain that the Labour Party there under his administration had very explicitly essentially cast open the doors to entry into Great Britain precisely for the purposes of changing the demographics and therefore the voting population of that country to the benefit of the Labour Party, the sort of counterparts to the Democrats. Let me ask you in closing, Jessica Vaughn, about one other issue that is much in the news at the moment, and that is that the Trump administration has decided not to continue the practice of extending this so-called temporary status to Salvadorans. We're hearing a lot of thrashing and gnashing of teeth about this. What's the story there, and how do you think this is going to sort out?
Well, this was the right move by the Trump administration, and one that is a return to following the letter of the law and intent of the law that was passed by Congress. Temporary protected status was supposed to be a temporary solution when people could not be returned to their home country because of some disaster there, like the airport was underwater or there was no, you know, infrastructure or way to, you know, for people to get back. It has been a de facto amnesty that no president has ever had the guts to rescind. You know, the termination of temporary status has been the exception rather than the rule. So the Trump administration has decided to wind it down, just as they did with DACA, give people until September of 2019 who are from El Salvador who have TPS. They were first awarded TPS back in 2001 because of some earthquakes there. And let's remember that while this has been characterized as some kind of humanitarian refugee program by the mainstream media and the left, in fact, it was basically just exemption from deportation and a work permit for people, most of whom were in the country illegally at the time of the disaster. They weren't affected by the earthquake. They were here in the United States living illegally, but they got a work permit because of an earthquake in their home country and have had it for now like 17 years. So it's silly. And in fact, you know, there's some discussion of, you know, the Democrats are trying to kind of sweep them into any DACA amnesty that they're able to get Congress to pass. There's a real risk of that. But President Trump did the right move. He said, look, we're going to wind this down. You have been living here for all these years now. You've accumulated savings. You've gotten work experience. You've lived in a civil society. You would be an asset to your home country, and it's time for you to go home. Time is up. And make plans to return. This is what Haitians were told, and it's the right thing to do.
It comes down to actually making our immigration policies what they claim to be. It's a high time, as you say. Jessica Vaughn, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for your time today and what really is truly exceptionally important work that you and your colleagues are performing at the Center for Immigration Studies. check it out. I believe I've got this right at cis.org. Is that correct?
That's right, cis.org. And thanks. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
And with you. I hope you come back often in 2018. And in the meantime, as I say, keep up the great work.
Next up, Michael Sturzenberger joins us. He's a leader of the freedom movement in Germany. We'll talk with him and, among other things, about some of his suffering at the hands of a regime that seems intent on suppressing his freedom of speech. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined for the first time by Michael Sturzenberger. He is a man who these days is a journalist. He is the author of a blog called Politically Incorrect. Previously, he helped run a very impressive party, now unfortunately closed in Germany, the Die Freiheit Party, or Freedom Party. He has suffered mightily of late for daring to engage in some freedom of expression. And we wanted to talk with him about his personal story as well as the larger drama playing out in central and eastern Germany, in which he is also, I believe, a leading force. It's great to have him with us. Michael Sturzenberger, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us. Happy New Year to you, sir.
It's a great honor for me. Hello.
I want to talk first about your personal story. As I understand it, you had the temerity to put on your blog an historical document. Tell us about it and what followed from your action.
I published a historical photo of the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem shaking hands with a Nazi. This showed the Nazi-Islam alliance in the 1940s in Germany. So I was accused to have shown the swastika. Yeah, and I told the police, no, it's a historical photo. You can't blame this. It's my right to do that. It's historical. Yeah, and it's an article about an historical happening.
And so what happened after the authorities challenged you about this photo?
It's unbelievable. The prosecution attorney, they brought me to court, and the judge sentenced me to 6 months on probation. The probation should last 3 years, and I should work 100 hours for social work. So it was unbelievable. It was my fully right, and they sentenced me.
Let me just be clear. They sentenced you to 6 months in prison, although they suspended it, you know, sort of the condition that for 3 years you didn't engage in this sort of thing again. This is an astonishing sentence for what was done here. And where do things stand at the moment?
It was really unbelievable. And we had a lot of reactions in the whole world. In Poland, and it came in the main television news in the evening, and newspapers reported about that, what's about the freedom of expression in Germany. I made an appeal. And 3 months later, at the beginning of December, we got a second trial. And then there was a good judge. And she said, oh, it was your right. It's everything okay. The photo, you had the right to publish the photo. And second, I was writing, Islam is a fascist ideology, as many Islam critics say, like author Hamed Abdel Samad. He wrote a book, Islamic Fascism, and he knows everything about it. And the judge said, and this is freedom of expression, you can say it, Islam is a fascist ideology, and now I am set free. You know, in the first trial, there was a left-orientated judge, and she wanted to silence me, that I stop my Islam criticism. She wanted that I fear prison, and then I would stop criticizing Islam in the next 3 years when I have to fear I'm coming to prison when I'm doing this.
So is this now the end of it, or is the government appealing, trying to continue to silence you? Because my impression has been that in Germany in particular, but elsewhere in Europe, of course, particularly what Donald Rumsfeld used to call old Europe. There has been a lot of this effort to appease the jihadis and not give offense to them and silence people like you, for that matter, for doing what you are entitled to do under the freedom of expression norms of the free world.
Yeah, the prosecution attorneys, they are hunting me. And you have to know, in Germany, they are working very strongly together with the government. And the government in Bavaria is ruled by the CSU, the Christian Democrats. And I was in that party some years ago. I was a press speaker in Munich, but I left that party because they didn't want to criticize Islam. So then I went to the new party, the Freedom, and since that they are hunting me. And they wanted, in the trial, they wanted 10 months in prison. So it's absolutely crazy what's going on.
But for the moment, they are not appealing to try to impose that sentence on you again, are they?
They try, but I'm sure we will win in the next instance.
We certainly hope that will be the case and want to support you in your stance for freedom of expression, Michael Sturzenberger. Speaking of Bavaria, I wanted to just ask you about an extraordinary recent visit there by the president of Hungary, Viktor Orban, who has really struck a very, very robust stance where it comes to this threat of Sharia supremacism, as I think of it, including talking about the Muslims who have come into much of Europe as invaders. Talk a little bit about the visit of Viktor Orban to Bavaria and what seems to be coming of it.
Yeah, he's a really brave man, and he was invited by the CSU because the CSU wants to change now her way of acting because they know they lose voters if they let the borders open for the Muslim refugees. And Viktor Orban said that 2018 will be the year of restoration of popular will. And he said, I am a border patrol captain, and Hungary will not accept Muslim refugees in the future either. And he said what the people of Europe want. They want security, protected borders, not having to live under threat of terror, and the return of unjustified asylum seekers to their homes. And he said, we do not consider these people to be Muslim refugees. We regard them as Muslim invaders. So this is a really, really strong expression.
It is indeed. And Viktor Orban has been a catalyst of something called the Visegrad movement, among other countries in, again, to use Donald Rumsfeld's phrase, New Europe. It seems as though the CSU in Bavaria is anxious to align itself now with the Visegrad nations. What are the implications of that, as you see it, for the European Union and its policies of essentially sapping the sovereignty of countries and forcing upon them open borders?
We have strong movements now in Europe, especially in Austria. We have a new government. They are now the FPÖ. They are very patriotic and they are very Islam critic, and they are now ruling in Austria together with the conservatives. And they start now to stop the asylum invasion, and they try to change the politics. And the CSU said, okay, this is good what's happening in Austria. And now it could be that these Visegrad states will make a coalition with Austria and some conservative politicians in Germany. So we will have maybe a change of attitude now, because it's so important. The politic of Angela Merkel is really, really dangerous for Germany and for the European Union. Yeah.
It's suicidal, it seems to me. We will be watching closely Viktor Orban's restoration of popular will in his own country and hopefully elsewhere in Europe. It's a desperate moment, as I need not tell you, Michael Sturzenberger. Your story speaks to that. We thank you for your leadership as well as for sharing some of your insights with us today. I hope you'll come back to us often in 2018. Next up, we will speak with Kenneth Taylor. Timmerman about, speaking of Islamic terrorism, what's going on in Iran at the moment, whether President Trump should support or help bring down the regime there, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to say we're joined by a fascinating investigative reporter and activist and human rights leader, really. A man at one point recognized for his contributions in that latter category with a nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize. He is Kenneth Timmerman. Among other incarnations, he is the president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran. And we'll be talking about some of his good works underway at the moment, in fact, in the European Parliament, where we have caught up with him. But before I turn to that, let me just mention some of his other accomplishments. He is the author of numerous best-selling works of both fiction and nonfiction, including a couple that are directly relevant to the work at hand. Shadow Warriors, Traitors, Saboteurs, and the Party of Surrender being one of them. Another, Countdown to Crisis, the coming nuclear showdown with Iran. He has contributed mightily to the public policy debate through his investigative reporting and commentaries elsewhere. And it's always good to have him with us for that purpose as well. Ken, thank you so much for taking a few minutes. I know you were testifying earlier today in the European Parliament. Tell us what you were talking about.
Well, we're talking about the Iran protests. We have a group of Iranian leaders and Iranian activists from a variety of ethnic organizations, ethnic groups in Iran, Kurds, Baluchis, Azeris, Abazis, and others. And I was there essentially to deliver a message to the European Parliament that the protests we're seeing today in Iran are very different from the ones we saw in 2009. These protests have given up on reform. There is no reform in this regime. They're asking for freedom. They're calling for the death of the dictator, and they're happening all over Iran, including the minorities. And while we were delivering this message here to the European Parliament, the European foreign ministers, ironically, on the other side of the building, were meeting with the Iranian foreign minister to figure out how they could save the Islamic regime in Iran.
Yeah, yet again. And this is really a fascinating backdrop for the topics that we wanted to talk to you about, Ken Timmerman, because the protests in Iran have seemingly moved off the front pages of the press here. Are they still underway? Are they taking place with the kind of depth that give them some legs? Or is the crackdown on the protesters having the usual effect of essentially snuffing what the people of Iran, certainly a very substantial number of them, want in terms of change, relief from this despotic Sharia supremacist regime?
I can tell you, Frank, that the crackdown has been a failure. And the protests are ongoing all across Iran today, something like 50 different locations. There were protests. These are rolling protests. They're not the millions of people in the streets that we saw in 2009, but remember what they were asking for in 2009. They thought their protests were approved by the regime. They were just asking for their vote. People in the streets today aren't asking for that. They say, we don't care about your vote. We don't want this candy that you are giving us. We don't want the green candy or the black candy or the red candy. We want freedom. And that is a very, very different thing. The protests have turned the corner. They are long lasting. I believe, and I said this today, I believe this is what revolution looks like.
Well, now, Ken, at the same time that that's taking place, you have not only the Europeans negotiating with the Iranian kleptocracy to try to keep them in business. You have the president of the United States facing an imminent decision, could happen at any time, about whether to continue to waive sanctions on this regime in the hope, I think he's being told, that somehow this will result in a willingness on the part of the Europeans, or for that matter, the Russians and Chinese, or for that matter, the Iranians to, quote, fix unquote, the Obama bomb deal, its various defects. From your vantage point, Ken, with the Foundation for Democracy in Iran and with your long experience with both the people of Iran and with this regime, what are the prospects that if the President of the United States actually does that, waives the sanctions, effectively continuing life support for the Iranian government, that he will be doing basically what Barack Obama did before him, which is to align with the regime that is oppressing the people of Iran rather than with the people, and almost certainly make inevitable the achievement of that regime's nuclear ambitions and threats to us?
Well, you're absolutely right about that. And President Trump has been very clear in all of his tweets and his statements so far. He's been telling the people of Iran, we are with you. And if he wants to put that statement into practice, the nuclear deal is insignificant in the long run because this regime is doomed to die. There's no saving the deal. It's a terrible deal. All it does is give goodies to the regime. The president should not certify the deal. He should look at new sanctions to impose on Iran. And I think the sanctions should really look at human rights abuses. They should, for example, you have today a former justice minister, Shahroudi, who's in Germany to get medical treatment. This is a man who was murdered, handed down death sentences to over 2,000 people, and the Germans have allowed him in on a diplomatic passport, whereas some people would like to bring him to the European Court of Justice. We should prohibit people from that, like that, from traveling. If he wants to get medical treatment, let him go to North Korea.
Well, you know, this, it's ironic, of course. You'll remember that it was the case of the United States offering medical treatment to the Shah of Iran that helped usher in this revolution that decades ago now brought to power this incredibly repressive regime, one that makes the Shah, I think, seem relatively benign by comparison. And I guess the question to you, Ken, is there seems to be within the president's circle, clearly people who want him to stay in the deal, who claim, as I say, they can fix it. They're working, we're told, with Senators Bob Corker, for whom the president, last time I checked, had pretty low regard. We had him on Air Force One, I guess, recently, perhaps for this purpose. But also Ben Cardin, the respectively chairman and ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The idea, I gather, is to try to fashion some new Corker-Cardin legislation that would facilitate this effort to fix the deal. Your thoughts on all of that, Ken?
Well, the president won the election in 2016 as a truth teller. He needs to continue telling the truth about the Iran deal, the worst deal ever negotiated by a U.S. president. And he needs to be very forthright about it. The Europeans support the deal because they support the regime. The Europeans think the protests in Iran today are about reform. They're not. President Trump needs to tell it like it is. He needs to stand up for the freedom of the people of Iran, which, by the way, is in our interest because a free democratic regime in Iran will not be pursuing nuclear weapons. It won't be sending the Quds Force around to its neighbors or delivering missiles to Yemen. They'll be building bridges and hospitals and schools and factories inside Iran.
Yeah. Now, Ken, you are, as we speak, in the company of some of those who are in the opposition to this Iranian regime. I know there are minorities, ethnic and otherwise, that make up this opposition. Can you just give us a sense from your interactions with them as to whether they have what it takes ultimately to bring about an alternative government along the policy lines that you just described, among other things?
Well, I think they do, Frank. They have a great deal of experience on the ground. They have political experience. They have guerrilla fighting experience in some cases, and they are learning the weapons of nonviolent protest. And one of my messages to them is that nonviolence is not for sissies. Nonviolence is carried out by an army of citizen soldiers. And you have the citizen sergeants, you have the platoon commanders, you have the lieutenants, and then you have a commander in chief somewhere. I believe there is actually a commander in chief behind these protests. I've heard from my sources there are cells in 130 cities around Iran that are organizing the protests. That's why this movement is not going away. And they have the people that I've been talking to that are here in Brussels. They want to see a free, democratic, secular Iran founded on some of the principles familiar to Americans: inalienable individual rights and limited government.
From your lips to God's ears, as they say, Kenneth Timmerman, I thank you so much for joining us and for what you are doing literally on the front lines of this fight now in the European Union and, of course, on this side of the pond as well. Keep it up, my friend, and give our best to those who are working with you to try to bring about this sort of fundamental transformation, shall we say, of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Lawrence Peck joins us next. We'll get the latest on North Korea's charm offensive and influence operations over there and here right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined once again, I'm pleased to say, by Lawrence Peck. He was visiting with us last week about developments in a country he's followed very closely for a long time, among other things, of late, as an advisor at the North Korean Freedom Coalition. He has been writing and commenting about this widely. His name is Lawrence Peck. His law degree is from Loyola University. He has been kind enough to share with us some insights into these developments in North Korea, and particularly its charm offensive. And I'm delighted to be able to regroup with him because it seems to be well underway at the moment. Lawrence, good to have you back. Thank you for taking a few more minutes to chat with us.
Well, I'm happy to be able to speak with you again.
Good. Let me ask you about when we last spoke, it was on the eve of the conversations about whether the North Koreans would be allowed to send an Olympic delegation to South Korea to participate in the games there next month. The meeting has now taken place. That is in the cards, evidently. There will be, in addition to athletes, quite a coterie of others from, you know, reporters and obviously government officials, but also cheerleaders. And there's been a lot of cheerleading about all of this, particularly in South Korea. Tell me what you make of the talks and what has come of them so far, Lawrence Peck.
As you indicated, the talks have resulted in the North now apparently planning to come to send a delegation to participate in the Pyeongchang Olympics held in South Korea, just south of the demilitarized zone on the eastern coast of South Korea. Interestingly, one point which has not been covered a lot in the media here is that the head North Korean delegate, the leader of the North Korean delegate to these talks, was a fellow by the name of Ri Son-gwon, Mr. Ri, and he has an interesting background, which I'd like to point out to some of your listeners, the first being that he was a former very hardline military official, a senior colonel, and he played a role in being one of those who helped organize and plan. He was actually the right-hand man of the individual who organized and planned the 2010 North Korean torpedo attack and sinking of a South Korean warship in international waters. And furthermore, he is an individual who in the past has made some of these blood-curdling threats against the South.
Yeah, and this makes all the more unsettling, the idea that the South Koreans would pursue so blithely the opportunity for not only this opening on the Olympics front, but apparently a much wider opportunity for entente, as they say, or detente with the North Koreans. I'm reminded as well of something you circulated about the time of these talks, some propaganda that the North Korean regime put out signaling its contempt for not only the South Korean government, but also for our own. Talk a little bit about that. Is this simply what, you know, totalitarians do internally when they are making an opening of this kind, or do you think this is indicative of their true intentions and aspirations, Lawrence Peck?
Well, I think it is indicative of their true motivations and aspirations. What you're referring to is the fact that from time to time, the North will send propaganda leaflets into the South by means of balloon, and they'll pop up on the streets of Seoul. In this particular case, it happened just literally hours before the beginning of the talks, which opened on January 9th. And this particular leaflet drop included a leaflet from the North, which depicted in cartoon form workers, presumably South Korean proletariat, stoning to death the presidents of both South Korea and President Trump of the U.S. Caption was that they would both be sent to their tomb. Now, again, this is from the same government, which just hours later was sitting down and professing the desire for peace and friendship and amity with the South Koreans.
Let me ask you, against this backdrop as well, the President of the United States has been indicating lately that he is open to negotiations with this Kim Jong-un character, or at least his representatives as well. Does this mark, in your estimation, Lawrence, a change and a worrying one, or is this kind of business as usual from previous administrations and despite the lack of much positive results from them, not particularly worrying?
Well, in theory, we've always been open to negotiations, discussions with the North Koreans, which we've had from time to time in the past. Your listeners may recall in past years we had various party talks, meaning the six-party talks or five-party talks or other numerical party talks with the North involving ourselves and the South Koreans and the Japanese and the Chinese.
Yes, not least the talks that Bill Clinton's administration ran that got the bomb for the North Koreans, as I recall.
Yes, you're referring to back in 1994, the failed, the disastrous agreed framework deal with the North Koreans, which, by the way, was negotiated in part by a lady by the name of Wendy Sherman, whose name was in the news more recently, a couple years ago, as one of the point people helping then Secretary of State John Kerry negotiating the equally disastrous Iran nuclear deal. So she had a role, a finger in both of those pies.
Yeah. So this model isn't very heartening. Should we be concerned about what President Trump has signaled so far?
Until now, the North Koreans have refused and have stated time and time again over the past several years that they would refuse to even discuss or contemplate in any way ending or even significantly limiting their ICBM testing and nuclear weapons development program. So although, of course, it's the position of the U.S. government that we would be able, through the increasing pressure we're putting on them, for example, through economic sanctions, that they finally would be able to discuss the elimination of that program, their denuclearization. They keep on telling us in a myriad of ways, publicly and privately, that they're completely unwilling to do so.
And I think that is, in fact, not just public posture. That is, in fact, their judgment and posture at the talks as well. Let me ask you, Vice President Michael Pence is headed to South Korea for the games and has indicated that in the meantime, it will be the policy of our government, despite this talk about an openness to negotiations of some kind, that we will maintain maximum pressure on the North Korean regime. I hope that is the case. Let me ask you, though, we've talking with you about this for some time now, Lawrence. Tell us very quickly, if you would, about North Korea's influence operations inside this country. How do they manifest themselves and to what end?
Well, their influence operations are part and parcel of the larger phenomenon of a pro-North Korean movement in the United States, a phenomenon which is very little understood and the existence of which isn't even known to even some of our top Korea experts, because it's somewhat of an esoteric topic, which I happen to follow closely. And it consists of the fact that there are here in the United States, just like during the Cold War period, there were pro-Soviet organizations and individuals. Now there are organizations and activists who are sympathetic to, defend, even support the North Korean regime. And there are basically three types of organizations and individuals that are involved in this pro-North network and movement in the U.S., one being your standard Marxist-Leninist and extreme left organizations, ranging from the International Answer Marxist-Leninist group to all the way down to the standard far left groups like Code Pink. Then on the other hand, you have Korean-American organizations, and of course these are only a tiny, tiny minority of the Korean-American community, but they do exist, and these are Korean-American groups which support the North, and they tend to be quite fanatic and have direct ties to and relations with the North Korean regime. And then finally, just as you had during the Cold War, there are what we term front groups. These are groups which are not overtly or publicly standing on street corners proclaiming their loyalty to the great leader of the North, but nevertheless, they are supporting in a camouflaged manner as to their motives, the North Korean regimes. And all of these various three different kinds of organizations are doing things like trying to impact the U.S. media and academia, and of course, lobbying the U.S. government, hoping against hope in changing U.S. policy towards the North in directions which the North would favor.
Lawrence Peck, thank you so much for taking the time today to discuss it with us, and I appreciate your insights into what's happening on that side of the Pacific as well as on this. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.